reason why women should have the vote are obvious to every fair minded person. We have waited too long for political justice. We refuse to wait any longer.
This is no simple reform. It really is a revolution.
An inclusive and intersectional feminism that calls upon all of us to join the resistance to racism, to Islamophobia, to anti-Semitism, to misogyny, to capitalist exploitation.
And our pussies ain't for grabbing.
Hello, and welcome to the Same Shit, Different Century podcast. I'm Amy Toll, and I'm here with
Amy Trent.
And Hannah Monkley.
So this week we're going to be talking about suffragettes and fashion, and mainly how they use fashion to convey their political message. So one of the first quotes I came across kind of sums up some of the important things about suffragettes and visual imagery. Was from Helen Pankhurst, Sylvia Pankhurst's granddaughter. And she said, "In the sometimes colourless and drab roll call of history, the suffragettes show panache and humour, using symbolism and merchandising, everything from cups and saucers to games, jewellery and clothes." And so we're going to hopefully, what I'm hoping is this podcast will just be on the fashion, because though we intended it to be about merchandising in the first place, I realised there was actually so much information out there that it sort of deserved to have two separate podcasts.
Also, it's the history of fashion is what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have a lot to job.
Say. So it seemed like there were lots of strands there was kind of a lot of stuff to talk about. And so one of the most important reasons that fashion was so important to the suffragettes was that suffragists in general were caricatured as unattractive, frumpy and matronly. So that was perpetuating the idea that women who wanted the vote were marginal figures, not to be taken seriously. So particularly in the WSPU, but also suffragists in general, the women were encouraged to look very feminine and very elegant. They wanted to show that it wasn't just a certain type of woman who wanted to vote, it was the best type of woman. So I don't know how honest they feel about that, but it is, you've got to think of it in the context.
Of the time, yeah.
So the sitters were uniformly well-dressed and elegant. They appeared providing a counter-narrative to the dishevelled, distressed images of suffragettes in the mainstream press. So this is the anti-suffrage caricatures.
Like saying that they were like men in drag.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've always got like a little suit on with tie.
Yeah, and they masculine. Look quite matronly, masculine. Yeah. So there was a quote I came across from Cicely Hamilton, who was very important in WSPU. And if you go to the Museum of London at the moment, which has an exhibition on, there is a oral recording of her speaking, which is really good, talking about how she joined the WSPU. And so that's really nice to hear. So she said, "A curious characteristic of the militant suffragette movement was the importance it attached to dress and appearance, and its insistence on the feminine note. In the WSPU, all suggestions of the masculine was carefully avoided, and the outfit of a militant setting forth to smash windows would probably include a picture hat. This taboo of the severer forms of garment was due in part to a dislike of the legendary idea of the suffragette as masculine in manner and appearance. Many of the militants were extraordinarily touchy on this point." Hannah, do you want to explain what picture hat is?
Okay, so sort of in Edwardian times, a picture hat is a very wide-brimmed hat that's often had a lot of decoration on it, like flowers and bows and feathers, and they're amazing. Actually, I have to say, in the pictures of the suffragettes, my favourite things are the hats, because some of them are crazy, some of them are really ridiculous.
It's a bit like... they're a bit like the ones that Audrey Hepburn wears, like at the Ascot races.
My Fair Lady.
That's a very theatrical.
I mean, even later, sort of teens think Rose and Titanic.
Yeah, sweeping hats,
that sort of thing. They're absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And I don't know, are you going to speak about, because we went to a talk the other night.
Oh, no, you can say.
Yeah, we went to a talk the other night at an exhibition called Millennial Rebels, which was awesome. The focus on that was the hats that the women wore. And they had a milliner make sort of hats inspired by the suffragettes. And Diane Atkinson, the author, was there. And she was talking about how these picture hats framed their faces. And, you know, at the time, as a lady, you didn't go out without a hat. If you didn't have your hat on, it was quite, you know, it wasn't proper. So these hats framed their faces so well. And then in protests and when there was police violence, the police would rip their hats off first and foremost to, you know, to make them look disheveled, to make them look unkempt and mannish, as Amy was saying.
Like, and take away their femininity.
Take away their femininity.
Always trying to make them live up to how they were being portrayed
and it's sort
by
of
the
like
anti-suffragists.
Like, really undignified thing, I guess, to do that. I thought also, someone said, and I read it, maybe it was the same one, when we went on the march, and that lady that shouted at us and said, "You Tories," and then, you know, that was quickly dispersed. But she was talking to my boyfriend who was there, and she was saying, oh, people rented picture hats.
Yeah.
And I heard someone on another podcast actually say, maybe she's the same person. That's her line. But that's quite interesting that maybe people would.
I guess it's the
really
same,
important.
You know, like actors used to hire their costumes and provide their own costumes for show. And it's almost the same in that it was almost a costume that they were wearing.
Yeah.
And it's not something you've maybe
it was something for show.
Have every day.
So
I kind of wanted to talk about what fashion was like at this time in history, though. I know a lot of our friends that will be listening will know this, so sorry. But just to kind of put it in context. And as it covers the suffrage movement, well, suffragettes we're talking about more, covers kind of quite a big period of change in fashion as well. So in the 1900s, the S-bend corset was very fashionable, which thrust the hips backwards and forced the chest forward into a fashionable pouter pigeon shape, emphasised with puff frilly blouses that were often embellished with decorations like lace collars and broad ribbon ties. Separates were popular with skirts fitted over the hips and fluted towards the hem. The hair was worn in the centre parting, often looped around pads and false hair to create a wide brim of hair around the hairline. This hairstyle was worn under vast broad brim hats with low crowns and adorned all over with flowers, lace, ribbon and feathers. Yeah. which I think most people can visualise, but also you can visualise it's quite a cumbersome thing to wear.
We've worn this for a day, haven't we?
But also I have to say, like, there's a lot of different corsets for different periods of history, and putting them on actresses, I have to say that actresses usually say that their S-bend corset is the most uncomfortable because it's such an unnatural position, like a pigeon. Like,
it's to visualise it, it's those, if you look at any of those photos of actresses of that period, those very glamorous photos, like, is it Evelyn Nesbit? You see a lot of images of her, and it's a very unnatural shape
stance,
really.
And also it covers such a huge portion of your body compared to like just your waist or your bust. It kind of goes right from your bust down
to your hips.
So you're really restricted.
So as we're kind of moving away from that to the sort of later 1900s, what becomes a bit more popular is the columnar silhouette, which was introduced by courtiers of Paris late in the decade, which signalled the approaching abandonment of the corset, but it as an indispensable garment, but it doesn't really go out for quite a while after that.
I think the cultural thing of like it being decent to wear a corset.
Yeah, you know. And I think that's the thing I wanted to kind of make this point about, that people were quite fascinated by corsets, and there's a lot of this idea, but it disappears kind of when there's always all these fashion designers like Paul Poiret and V&A that claim that they got rid of the corset, which is sort of like, I think it's interesting how it's such a big statement of that period of fashion that everyone wants to lay claim to it, that they freed women from it.
You think there were still like forms of corsets going until like the 50s, 60s.
Yeah, exactly. But then also what's interesting with this period is sportswear and tailored fashion starts to become more popular. So it sort of brought a new trend of the new woman who was active and required less constrictive clothing, simpler and more streamlined. The new woman was highly encouraged by women's suffrage. Women that identified with this fashion movement were the type of women that were beginning to venture out of a domestic circle and that were told, and they were told to maintain and beginning to pursue higher education, office jobs, and participating in active outdoor sports. The new and improved fashions allowed for women to swing a tennis racket, whack a golf ball, but the idea is a proper feminine attire reduce the progress of a more practical sportswear. So you start to get, this is sort of where you get tailored suits more. And because more women were going into white collar jobs. So that's more sort of secretarial. I mean, that's kind of what they were doing in the WSPU as well, weren't they? Like the women working in the offices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then tailored suits with no frills allowed for women to maintain an office job, to seem more masculine and blend into the male-dominated environment. Shortly, the number of women attending colleges increased and the shirtwaist became popular among the average college girl. So I'm not so sure about shirtwaists, actually. I don't know if that seems more of an American term to me.
Yeah, I think so.
Woolen tweed suits were becoming popular and they featured ankle-length skirts with matching jackets. Ladies of fashion wore them with fox furs and huge hats.
Can I just say something, actually, that someone was showing me and Hannah some pictures last year of this period. I can't remember the photographer's name, but it was some women around London and their skirt lengths, some of them were so short.
A lot shorter than I expected.
Than you would have thought that they would be wearing. They were kind of...
What date was that then?
It was 1906?
I was about to say 1906.
1906, I think.
I don't want to say the name of the...
Right. Having worn them, it was just so much more... Even just a couple of inches above the ankle is so much more practical than an inch below the ankle.
And some of them were almost like... They were mid-calf.
Really?
Yeah. I think they were schoolgirls.
Yeah, I feel like you see more schoolgirls, definitely, in that period. And there's those suffragettes that you see advertising one of the fundraisers with the maypole, and they have those quite short skirts, and that's 1909.
Lovely.
So also kind of what's interesting about this decade is, as I was mentioning before, this flowering of Parisian haute couture. And they became the arbiter of styles and silhouettes for women of all classes. And what I think is relevant for this, because we're bringing it back into the suffragettes and how they use the media, is they sent models to places like the Longchamp races to wear stars. So, you know, those photos that you see, which you don't think those women are like really well dressed. And I didn't realise they were models, actually. But I think this is important because it's this idea of using the media to advertise. And it's this really like a period of time when the media, newspaper media, printed media is like becoming like vastly distributed.
Distributed.
it's something that people that are trying to advertise their work or campaigns are using. So that's kind of like, I'm probably going to say this long, but Calais Soirs, which is the Calais sisters, which aren't so well known.
Oh, Soeurs.
Soeurs, that's it, Soeurs. Yeah. And Paul Poirot, as I said before, do say, I think I was listening to this new podcast about fashion and I think they said Paquin was the first one that maybe did that though. Yeah, because I think there's a lot of things where they say like actually he took claim for things that she did first. Yeah.
Is this for sending models to the races?
Yeah, and also stuff to do with the corset and
right, okay.
So the new styles of fashion were variously called, and I can't really say this, the merveilleuses, which I'm not so...
Marvelous.
Yeah, maybe that.
I'm guessing.
Yeah, directoire, which... No, and the empire. after fashions of the turn of the 19th century, which they resembled in their narrow skirts and raised waistlines. And it's kind of interesting because it's that period of time is when there's a lot of revolution in France and internationally. So it's sort of, yeah, interesting how it's something that's happening at the turn of the 20th century. So the other movements, I just wanted to touch on these movements because I think that it's kind of important in the sense of like women's emancipation.
Definitely.
So one of them is dress reform, which does date back to the Victorian period, when, you know, women were in much more even restrictive clothing than the Edwardian period.
And can I just say that we did a mannequin challenge like a few years ago and I had to wear a crinoline and I couldn't even walk in that.
That's the big cage that holds the skirt out really wide. Think like the King and I.
Yeah, and it's really heavy and
you have to walk in tiny steps and it's very constrictive.
Anything to get rid of that.
So this is also known as the rational dress movement. And it's sort of related to the first wave of feminism in the United States and Britain. And they were kind of advocating for clothing that was more practical and comfortable than the fashions of the time.
This is actually one of my favourite ever kind of fashions.
Oh, what, dress reform?
Yeah.
So, yes, dress reformers were also influential in persuading women to adopt simplified garments for athletic activities such as bicycling and sort of swimming. And then the other thing, so I went to another talk where someone mentioned the anti-tight lacing association, I thought was quite funny. So for dress reformers, corsets were a dangerous moral evil, promoting promiscuous views of female bodies and superficial dalliance into fashion whims. The obvious health risks, including damaged and rearranged internal organs, which compromised fertility, weakness and general depletion of health, were also blamed on excessive corsetry. Eventually, the reformers' critique of the corset joined a throng of voices clamouring against tight lacing, which became gradually more common and extreme as the 19th century progressed.
You can really see why kind of first wave feminism happened sort of 1860s, just because
when tight lacing started.
Like you're tight laced up, you can barely move in your petticoats and your underskirts and your crinolines, and it's just, I feel like that's the worst period to be a woman ever.
It's funny if you read women's magazines how like tight lacing is endorsed, and then around this time it's like, oh my God, like this is evil, and you know, as you get further along,
I find
they turn it into a sexual thing, which I think there was like a bit of a movement of.
Yeah, but this is interesting because they say, whereas for many corseting was accepted as necessary for beauty, health and an upright military style posture.
Dress. To be fair, like I think corsets are quite good for
posture.
They are.
But you don't need to lace them so tightly.
In particular, actually did squeeze organs where they shouldn't be. But if you lace a corset,
we went to a party and we had to go into the toilet and like loosen Hannah's.
Oh yeah,
because she nearly passed out.
Nearly fainted. Yeah, a Moulin Rouge thing. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was thinking, I don't know about this.
Sorry.
going awful.
So, dress reformers viewed tight lacing as vain, and especially at the height of the era of the Victorian morality, a sign of moral indecency, which I thought was quite like that.
Yeah.
Moral indecency. I mean, I think the thing is, like, I can understand wearing a corset actually for that sort of support, but I think there's probably people that were really extreme, and I suspect there's a lot of people that didn't lace their corsets like that tightly. So kind of following on from that is aesthetic dress or artistic dress, which was largely a movement which started in the 1870s, led by Mary Eliza Howice. Which is sort of a similar thing. She sought to reform and to enhance and celebrate the natural shapes of the body, preferring the loose lines of the medieval and Renaissance eras. A historic nostalgia for more forgiving fashions, the aesthetic dress movement critiqued fashionable dress for its immovable shapes and sought the fashioning and adorning of a robe as tastefully complementary to the natural body.
I love these dresses. I love an aesthetic
dress. Yeah.
We should put a photo up of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And there was this other talk I went to. There's this enamelist called Ernestine Mills, who was a suffragette. And there's a panel in the Museum of London that she designed. I completely forgot their names, but it was the women, two suffragettes and their mother, who dedicated their house to hunger strikers coming out of hospital.
Oh,
the Mouse Hospital.
Oh,
Brackenbury, I think. Okay, that's not even I think it was that. There were other ones. So, and in the middle of that, there is a woman in a purple gown, and it is like aesthetic dress or reform dress because it's loose.
They kind of almost look like early dressing gowns.
But yeah.
Just gorgeous with like embroidery and...
Yeah,
amazing.
We'll definitely put up a picture.
So, although the Victorian dress reform movement itself failed to enact widespread change in women's fashion, social, political and cultural shifts into the 1920s brought forth an organic relaxation of dress standards. With new opportunities for women's college, the National Suffrage Amendment of 1920 and the women's... which I think this is America, like I've just realised, because 1920 is when they got the... sorry, this is obviously not just things I wrote myself. no, I've admitted it. I've just copied off Wikipedia. but it's the same.
Come on.
I'm sorry, I've got a full-time job. and women's increased public career options during and after World War I, fashion and undergarment structures relaxed along with the improved social standing of women, embodying the new woman idea. Women don't masculine-inspired fashion, including, well, I've done this before, so I'm not going to say the same thing, but, yeah, tailored suits, ties and starched blouses. Lady Duff Gordon, who was a fashion designer, Lucille, as well, who was famous for being on the Titanic and escaping with her husband, she said, women took off their corsets, reduced their clothing to the minimum tolerated by conventions and war clothes, which wrapped around them rather than fitted. As Amy actually said, corsets, girdles and bras were worn, well, we all still wear bras, I don't know what they're on about there, but we're talking to the 1960s. Okay,
I do actually have a bra.
Yeah, it's just going to turn into a different podcast. as someone stated, a feminine emancipation had bought... greater dress reform than the most visionary of the early feminists have advocated. So that's what I kind of think is important, that I do think all these things that were going on and women's suffrage being a big part of that is kind of what did change how women dressed.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Huge part of it.
So then going back onto the suffragettes and talking about what their aesthetic was. So at the time... which we talked about in previous episodes, where they kind of had this rebranding, which 1907, 1908, where they kind of went in this very distinct direction of having the colour scheme, the purple, white and green, which I'm not going to repeat what it stands for again, because everyone should know by now. We're just like bored stiff.
And if you don't know, go back and listen from episode number one.
So we should have like a quiz or something. So as people will know now, the branding genius of this was Emmeline Pethick Lawrence. And there was somebody actually on Women's Hour this week who was talking about who was a relative of hers, which is kind of interesting cool. to listen to. So they had a big, which Hannah talked about marches, was it last week or the week before?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, the one before, Amy's last one, which was the Women's Sunday March in June 1908. And at this point, you know, she encouraged people to wear their finest white dresses with tricolour sashes. And this quote from Votes for Women kind of sums it up. Be guided by the colours in your choice of dress. We have 700 banners in purple, white and green. The effect will be very much lost unless the colours are carried out in the dress of every woman in the ranks. White or cream tussle, which is a silk. I'm not quite sure, actually.
Yeah, tussle silk.
Tussle, yeah. I can't quite visualise what that is, but should, if possible, be the dominant colour. the purple and green should be introduced where other colour is necessary. You may think that this is a small and trivial thing in the movement. That isn't what she said, I just read that wrong. I wish I could impress upon every mind as deeply as I feel myself the importance of popularising the colours in every way upon open to us. If every individual woman in this union would do her part, the colours would become the reigning fashion, and strange as it may seem, nothing would so help to popularise the WSPU. Now, everyone has simply got to see to it that everywhere our colours may be in evidence. So, yeah.
That, really driving the point home.
Yeah, then, and it kind of seems a bit like, oh, okay. But I do get her point, because actually it's that visual impact.
Mm.
And this, apparently this did work. So one of the papers of the Times reported, at the head of each procession was carried a flag of purple, white and green. And after that, the regimental colours, so to speak, a beautiful banner also in purple, white and green with artistic embroidery and symbolic devices. Each group marched under a banner of its own, and every woman walking in the procession wore the purple, white and green, either in the favours pinned to their breast, or in the trimmings of the hat, in belt ribbons, or in the shoulder sashes. Many of the ladies wore costumes designed in an arrangement of purple, white and green, white frocks being the general wear. And there's lots of images. So on the Museum of London, they have a huge archive of suffrage ephemera? I can't say that word. And there's lots of pictures in that, which I've got in my notes, but obviously you can't see my notes. So
we'll post them.
Yeah. So, Instagram. Yeah, lots of lovely images of groups of women in white with their sashes.
Also, I was going to say, even if you just check out the photos of Christina Broom, there's loads of pictures of women in white.
Yeah. And didn't somebody say that en masse, with wearing white with the purple, white and green, they look like a sea of flowers?
Yeah, I think that's what Emmeline Pankhurst said.
Amidst all the dark colours that everyone else was wearing who weren't in the suffrage movement, which is nice.
So they also had a drum and fife band, which have quite a cool uniform, which had 20 members and was actually led by Mary Richardson, who was the famous suffragette who slashed the Rockaby Venus in the National Portrait Gallery. So the band dressed, they were in purple, white and green, obviously. But they had frogged jackets and skirts of shocking brevity with peaked caps. These skirts are quite short. These are like knee.
Ooh la la.
Oh.
They are, aren't they?
Hold on. Sorry, my chair's really squeaky to anyone that's annoying. Yeah, that's... Yeah.
In my head, I was imagining the frogging silver, but it's obviously not. But I kind of want to introduce a few suffragettes that maybe weren't heard of along the way. And some people that know about fashion and costume history will obviously know this. But Edith Craig, she was the daughter of Ellen Terry, the famous actress, the Victorian actress, who there's that image of her with the beetle wing, the scarab beetle wing dress that you see a lot.
Gorgeous.
And so actually her daughter Edith was, she was a costume designer. So that's kind of...
was nice. Our bag.
Yeah, it was a nice little thing when I saw that in one of the books I was researching. So I feel like she was a bit of a character. So she said that she was a member of 8 different suffrage societies, and she kind of seemed to claim that she did a lot within a lot of them. So who knows? But she was influenced by her mother, who was an ardent feminist. And at school, she said there was an interminable addressing of envelopes for suffrage petitions, but obviously it got into her psyche to do it. So she was a costume designer for Henry Irving, which he was a very famous impresario, theatre director of sort of late, I think, Victorian Edwardian period.
I have under my desk some like good pictures of him, his shows. So I guess she...
Yeah.
I've got like the show bills.
That's what I thought.
So I guess she must have designed them.
Yeah, she was also an actress. So there's a picture on her Wikipedia page of her and her mother dressed up in sort of Renaissance costume. I quite like this because where we work, this is kind of very true of. Edith was noted for her expertise in historically accurate costumes, and she gained a lot of recognition for that.
Oh, we like her.
Yeah.
So there's banners that she designed, but they don't exist, unfortunately, anymore. And She produced Cicely Hammond's Pageant of Great Women in 1909, which is, I think, what that pageant where there's like Charlotte Bronte.
Okay.
I'm assuming it's that one.
Was that the coronation procession?
I think that's a different one. I feel like that is a different one. Because I think coronation one is 1911.
Yeah.
So I think also I kind of got the impression there was other ones where she was a director as well. So she directed some, because when we see those marches, the photos, and actually when I looked at those Charlotte Bronte, the Victorian costume, I was like, well, they're kind of amazing costumes. I know people wouldn't know, but how would they know? So that kind of makes sense now that there was
where
someone.
Where did they get these costumes from?
I was looking at that picture with Elizabeth, our friend Elizabeth, who is like the expert, and she was saying that she thinks that they were all, everything they were wearing was original.
That's really cool.
There was an insistence on a refined and stereotypically, I'm finding it really hard to say words today, ladylike appearance. And this was sort of this idea that it would diffuse fears about violent tactics, reassuring onlookers that these women were refined without them having actually to say anything. This focus on presentation served another purpose. It brought more women around to the cause. National Portrait Gallery has an exhibition at the moment, and the curator there was saying they wanted to attract women. They wanted to demonstrate that this was a huge movement, if there had been loads of frumpy, unattractive women, lots of women would have been put off. If women could see that they were to be walking along in a beautiful procession, looking their best they could possibly look, it was very persuasive. And there's some nice things about what it meant for suffragettes themselves. It meant to women the discovery of their own identity, that source within of purpose, power and will. And one said the suffrage campaign was our Eton, Oxford, our regiment, our ship, our cricket match, which actually I think all those things at that time weren't accessible to women.
Mm. That's true, yeah.
So but you think though, and they're very male, still very idea with these clubs that women aren't allowed to be part of, but you guys don't think of at the time.
Well, they're allowed to be part of them, but just in a very derogatory way.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and Emmeline Pankhurst said it was our education in the living identification of the self with the corporate whole. Just kind of now that we're on Emmeline Pankhurst, I wanted to find more quotes in this, but I couldn't find as much as I was hoping for. So I mentioned when I did my episode about Sylvia that she was not that into fashion, that she didn't really care that much for it. I don't know, maybe she did slightly because she was artistic, but I don't think it was at the forefront of her mind. And she's always noted for having a hole in her stocking, having a bag that's overflowing.
Something on back to front.
Oh,
which I've done before. I'm sure I heard her
I
wear
did it
something
on
back front.
Monday.
Okay.
So I was like, Amy, you do realise your jumper is on inside out.
And she actually says, and I think she maybe meant this in quite a derogatory, and probably a lot of people have heard this quote, many suffragists spent more money on clothes than they can comfortably afford rather than run the risk of being considered auteur, I'm not sure how you say that, and doing harm to the cause. So Emmeline and Christabel were considered very glamorous.
Yeah, very fashionable.
And
actually, going back to what you were saying about picture hats, there's that photo of Christabel voting.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Is that what you were going to say? Yeah. The most perfect example of a picture hat that I've ever seen.
It's absolutely massive.
We'll put a picture of that up as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so I'm sure, I just cannot find the time, but I'm sure I've read lots more quotes about like how they dress particularly, but I couldn't really necessarily find them, which was a bit disappointing. So I'm going to skip forward a bit because I'm worried we're running out of time. So this avoidance of sartorial affront did work, and membership numbers grew, and it became fashionable to identify with the struggle for the vote, even if only by wearing a small piece of jewellery, picked out in semi-precious coloured stones or enamel, which I'm going to talk about jewellery next time. Members were obviously encouraged to wear the colours, and Selfridges and Liberties sold tricolour striped ribbon for hats, belts, rosettes and badges. And there was coloured garments, underwear, handbags, soap, slippers and toilet soap.
Oh, underwear. I didn't know that. That's fun.
There is another bit, actually.
It's like a little cheeky, cheeky way to have your allegiances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know it's there.
Yeah, I know. And there's also those stockings that they have. They have some in the Museum of London that have the black with the kind of cross-stitch embroidery.
Oh,
there's
lovely.
Like Vates women's, so it's like fashion ankle. So like kind of what I touched before and saying how important it was in and how they were aware of how the press would pick up on it. So they were one of the sort of first political campaigns to exploit new publicity methods made possible by the rise of national daily penny and halfpenny newspapers. The first or among the first to adapt the traditional broadsheet or the contemporary advertising post into a new political instrument, and the first to develop a pictorial rhetoric which drew on but also challenged the ideas of bourgeois Edwardian femininity. So I quite like pictorial rhetoric. I think that's quite a nice but it's that idea that they were thinking of how it's going to be seen in a newspaper, so wearing all whites, that actually how much that's going to be a very strong image. So just kind of going back to what was going on in the newspaper industry at that time, the Daily, founded in 1896, which rapidly achieved a daily circulation, it's convenient for the title, of 1 million.
yeah, it would have been awkward if it was.
The Daily News, Daily Sketch, Daily Mirror and Daily Mail all built up tremendous circulations in the late Victorian Edwardian period and enhanced their appeal with photographic reproductions. In a few years, hardly a newspaper office of importance was without its photo engraving department, which is to say that the development of photographic reproductions in the daily press and the development of a suffrage spectacle go hand in hand. As we said, suffragists knew how to court the press, and they also knew, given the limited opportunities for women journalists, that meant courting an overwhelmingly masculine and conservative profession, which that is what I think is quite important when maybe people feel a bit like, well, ugh, this over femininity, this like, you know, over the top, female idea, thing that they would attract. That kind of makes sense. Like, well, how else are they going to attract the attention?
I mean, people do it on other levels today.
You know, if you were kind of a protest, if you know, even just like a fur protester or something today, and you're just kind of dressed normally, nobody or the media particularly wouldn't pay attention to you. But if you go out wearing something wacky and something that stands out against what you're with, then you're going to get media attention.
So there were some things that they weren't so keen on people wearing, and Mrs. Pankhurst, which is not that surprising, disapproved of women wearing trousers, because I guess she didn't think it was very feminine. Just going back to it being an idea of how important the clothing was, there was an idea that if you went into prison that you shouldn't give up your clothing. That, and we know we talked about in the hunger strike when I sort of said that they didn't want to wear, that if they were classed as criminals, they had to wear that prison uniform, and if you were a political prisoner, you could wear your own clothes. But Emmeline Pankhurst, a kind of instructed activist, to resist wearing prison clothes and to retain their own clothing as possible, if at all possible, unless undressed by force.
So you've just reminded me as well, I'll just quickly mention, something that I meant to talk about in the prison episode, but I completely forgot while we were recording it, was the arrows on the uniforms. Is basically, it's a broad arrow and it goes back to kind of the Middle Ages, and it pretty much means like belongs to the king. Because you know when they went on, the prisoners went on procession holding the sticks with the arrows on top as
to
well,
say that they
show
been,
that they've been
yeah.
prisoned.
Yeah.
So it basically meant they were kind of property of the king.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. They want to look beautiful. They don't want to look conspicuous. So the less inconspicuous they appeared, the less likely they were to be singled out. Thus, overly elaborate or unusual dress was discouraged and moderation reigned. Aside from sporadic and rather brief directives on what to wear during processions and shape, well, it doesn't matter so much, but they're sort of saying that they weren't told what to wear the rest of the time.
Only during their public sessions. Outings.
Among the fashions mentioned between 1908 and 1911, the only garment of dress that was specifically condemned was the hobble skirt, a narrow skirt that varied in shape and style, but which effectively restricted easy mobility and prevented a natural gait. Innovative interpretations of at home or classical dress by the House of Lucille, as well as the exotic and orientalist designs of Paul Poiret, who introduced the harem pants into mainstream fashion, as well as various designs for hobble skirts, were rejected by the majority of suffragettes as being too experimental. It just makes me think.
I just think you can't run away from a policeman in a hobble skirt. There's a practical issue there as well.
So thus, fashionable and expressive dress was encouraged, but within limits. In fact, overly elaborate dress was sometimes associated with anti-suffragists. In 1910, a columnist noted in a report of an anti-suffrage meeting that there was seen a sprinkling of ladies in hobble skirts. That suffragettes often eschewed experimental or overly eccentric dress is further underlined when a speech at a WSPU organised event in 1911, Miss Elizabeth Robbins wittily suggested that for the male attendees who felt threatened by the cause, the odd sartorially hobbled women, in conjunction with the abundance of sweet foods, feminine pleasures and domestic niceties, would put them at their ease. The hobble skirt came to the fore at the psychological moment when women were unhobbling themselves in every other direction. And I feel sure that the spectacle of thousands of women meekly submitting to the tyranny of the hobble skirt has been a priceless comfort to many an anxious soul.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true.
Yeah, it's quite funny, actually, because it's like being shackled.
Yeah, I mean, I've worn one. They're really, really annoying. You can't spread your legs. I mean, I don't mean that in a rude way, but you literally, like, have to trot to walk. It's really weird. It's annoying.
So there is a bit where they kind of suggest that in this section I've got that it might be a good thing in reassuring opponents of women seeking the vote of their relative ineptitude, something that they might subversively belied in their actual actions. So I suppose it is the opposite, that you could appear a bit constrained, but actually so that you seem harmless.
Oh, yeah.
Like a trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite a clever trick, but maybe wouldn't be noticed, but...
a subtle trick.
So coming back then to like a specific suffragette, who, just because it's interesting for what she wore, she's one of the few people that maybe didn't kind of go into line with wearing this very feminine kind of attire, which was Ethel Smyth, who is the composer, right, who composed the March for the Women.
Yeah, that's the one we played the clip of in the March episode.
Yeah, so she was noted for being a tweed-wearing, pork-pie, hat-sporting, and Sylvia said of her, her features were clean-cut and well-marked, wearing a small mannish hat, battered and old, plain-cut country clothes, hard-worn by weather, and usually, I think that's probably supposed to be, she would don a tie of the brightest purple, white and green, or some hideous purple cotton jacket or other oddity in the WSPU colours she was so proud of, which shone out incongruously like a new gate to old palings, which I feel is a bit mean. I'm sure I read something.
What is she wearing?
Yeah. But it's kind of interesting, like, there was the right colours to wear and to be worn in the right way, and then there was just being a bit gauche and just not quite, yeah.
Oh, well, I like the idea of Ethel Smyth.
I like her even more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she kind of trod her own path.
Yeah.
So then what's kind of important is how this was picked up by the department stores and commerce. And I'm sorry, this is quite a long quote, but I kind of think it's quite interesting. So sorry.
Go for it.
So this is from a book that I just want to mention that's in the British Library. So I went and joined the British Library the other week, and it's a book about suffrage imagery. So it's really great for what I was doing, but I couldn't buy a copy because it was like £600.
What?
So it was right. So it's quite nice to go to the British Library, but this is I had to like frantically type away.
Is it worth it though? Is it a good
book? Was quite a good book. It hasn't got a lot about fashion. It's got a lot about the banners and other stuff. But I just wanted to say this would frame what I'm going to try and say. British suffragists often echo the American commentator Thurstin Veblen, apparently unwittingly, in drawing a parallel between the bourgeois wife as a vicarious consumer and the exemplar of her husband's wealth and the decadent luxury of the ancien regime. They demanded, in effect, a modernising of femininity that would grant women a stake in the rights of a 19th century bourgeois man, citizenship, education, employment without patronage, and a voice in the state. They pleaded for something sober, respectable, and reasonable in the expense of frivolity and display, usually signified in the representation of anti-suffragists encumbered by the bonnets and crinolines of a less enlightened period. In this, the suffragists would undoubtedly be helped by the department store, and their own investment in the image of the woman as a new kind of consumer. What has been called the new commerce opened up employment opportunities women, but more significantly addressed women as consumers, inviting them to identify with specifically modern images of themselves, including things that are active, sporting, like we've mentioned before, together with public transport, public laboratories for women, the growth of tea rooms and the gradual decline of the chaperone, department stores helped to open up middle-class women to the hetero masculine domain of modern public and urban life. Which I think that, I'm sorry, it's a bit long, but it's liked how it's phrased because
it sums it up really well. Yeah.
Mm.
And I was thinking, I don't know if anyone's seen the series Mr. Selfridge.
Yeah, I was just thinking
about the department store. Yeah, Selfridges. And there's a lot about suffrage in there. And how they cashed in on it, didn't they? Mr. Selfridge did. They sold.
Well, yeah, that's the kind of thing that they recognise the potential power of the suffragettes, which the politicians didn't, obviously.
And I think I remember reading that the suffragettes, they responded really well, and they actually really had a good relationship with Selfridges for a long time.
Yeah, they didn't smash their windows.
Yeah, the window, but they did, but I think it was, they were the last window that they smashed on Oxford Street as, like, a very last resort, like, they knew they needed another window, so they did Selfridges, but they really held out for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. So what Harry Selfridge did, as long with quite a lot of other retailers, was they advertised in Votes for Women. Mm. And so that kind of, it was like, if you bought from those people, you were supporting the cause because they would be advertising.
Yeah.
And that's where they were getting some of their revenue, obviously, from advertising in the magazine.
Mm.
Because
the WSPU had a lot of money.
Mm.
They had more, I think they were the political party with the most money at this period?
I'm not sure.
They had more than the Liberals.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I know I read something once about they were one of the biggest political party, political parties that we call them.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that time, like they had the biggest sort of, they employed the most people.
Yeah.
That's awesome, actually.
Yeah, it's really awesome.
That's really cool.
Sorry, I have to kind of... So, when I was saying about them encouraging women to buy from the retailers that advertise in Votes for Women, they would have actually had a really good choice of items to ensure a suitably modish appearance. So things that were advertisers enticed them with pictures of dresses, dainty blouses, charming hats, smart coats and hair care products. And I think like going back to that Women's Sunday, them saying, oh, wear white dresses, that actually was a huge, that's kind of like, I think they say between 20,000, 250,000 women that would have been going out and buying white dresses.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So in Votes for Women, they said, "One cannot walk down Bond Street and the neighbourhoods without being struck by the fact that our colours are evidently going to be the leading shades in the autumn and winter months. Almost every shop window is showing purple hats and green hats, purple ties and green ties, purple gowns and green gowns in endless variety. Mrs. Oliver was the first of the Bond Street dressmakers to realise the value of the Votes for Women as an advertising medium, and her prices, considering the neighbourhood, are exceedingly moderate." Another dressmaker who takes keen interest in the women's fight for the vote is Elspeth Phelps of 49 South Moulton Street. Miss Phelps, who is an ardent suffragette, has some exquisite models on view, and one of those shown to our representatives was admirably adapted to the purple, white and green, a decoratoire gown which would be made in a dark shade of purple cloth with a dainty yoke and tuck sleeves, a white net edged with a narrow band of green silk, or the colours might be reversed. I just quite like the description, how much detail there is.
Yeah, that's lovely. That's so really lovely kind quote.
Of yeah. Visualise. There's a lot of stuff, which maybe it gets a bit dull to read, but about where, I just kind of like this idea of where people would buy their clothes from. And there's lots of things, obviously, places that don't exist anymore, and things outside of the big department stores where people would have been going to much smaller dressmakers.
Wasn't this around the time as well when mail order started to become quite a big thing?
I think so, yeah.
So there's lots, you start to get mail order catalogues where you can kind of get a catalogue and read a description and send your money in the post to order it and get it posted to you. Mm. I'm sure that was around this time.
I quite like, there's a William Owen in Westbourne Grey that stocked long purple serge coats whose collars and cuffs were trimmed in green and bordered with white. So I quite like that description. And there's lots of things about, yeah, princess dresses and gauze scarves and for matering. So you see, like, I think there's those ones that, they've got one in the Museum of London that has the coloured stripes and says Votes for Women at the bottom.
Yeah.
Which I think is a motoring scarf. So there was...
Did you watch the Claire Baldwin documentary on Emily Wilde and Davison? And they were saying that that was what they were trying to, or she was trying to attach to the King's horse.
Oh, her scarf.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a banner.
Yeah, well, this was a very... It was a... I mean, they didn't have 100% conclusive evidence to back this up, but it was a theory.
Oh, okay.
And a woman had the actual scarf that she said was the actual scarf.
Yeah, this is actually another thing that I thought sounded quite nice. Bedroom slippers in velvet and quilted, satin dyed in the colours.
Oh, I love slippers.
That sounded really nice.
I love them, yeah.
See, I knew they wore the colours, but I really didn't know the extent of... Yeah. Everything you can imagine in the colours.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's just like it's a very good marketing campaign make something that, and the colours, like people, I think the part of the reason people remember the suffragettes and people get annoyed about them not remembering the suffragists is this thing of like the colour scheme and, you know, that they had this widespread of visual merchandising. And I've read it both ways round, but the one that I've got notes on here is that because it was so successful, that's when the NUWSS adopted their colour scheme, the red, green and white.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
And then all
that.
The other suffrage campaigns followed.
Yeah.
But then I've heard it the other way around as well, so I don't know who knows what the truth is.
Yeah.
So there was also, there was even a suffragette who wore the colours to her wedding.
I love that.
So in August 1909, Miss Ruth Robson married Reverend T. Dring at Bowes Park in East London. According to a report in Votes for Women, the colours were greatly in evidence, appearing in the bride's bouquet, the wedding favours and the buttonholes, while the bride's going away dress was in purple, white and green.
That's so good.
Members of the local union dressed in colours wearing regalia and carrying banners formed a guard of honour at the station, and the bride and groom were given a hearty send-off.
I love that.
And just say, because would you say the groom was the reverend?
Yeah, I know. So I thought that was quite nice.
So he would have been like such a highly... protected member. I think that's of the society.
Thing. Like, you come across this. I mean, I think if you've seen that film Suffragette, and I completely understand why they did this, where Ben Whishaw is Carey Mulligan's partner, and he just completely disowns her. But you just read a lot of stuff where husbands didn't do that. Where they
so supportive.
I think it did. It did happen a lot. You know, with husbands and fathers and employers, and that should be talked about because it's awful, and it shows shows the sacrifice that so many women made, and how is vilified the right word?
Yeah,
but you are right, like there were so many male supporters and male suffragists that they don't get spoken about in history either.
And there's also, I came across an article with some interesting adverts for corset makers, and it's just interesting how they, they're called I&L Hammond, and how they adopted their adverts to be in the Votes for Women magazine. So before, they've just kind of got a corset advert that's like, you know, supply comfortable, well-fitting corsets to suit all figures at moderate prices. So then they, the next one is the top in big letters is supports women's work by patronising a business owned and managed by women, and where women are employed to make, fit and sell corsets. So it's kind of aligning themselves also with this cause. But that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so, very much.
We'll definitely put a picture of that on the Instagram.
Yeah.
It's really, has she gone from blonde to brunette as well?
Yeah, probably it's true, actually.
Amy's got a comparison of the
yeah.
advert.
Yeah, it's like advert not very interesting. But no,
we'll put a picture of it up.
Yeah. There was something I came across, actually, when you were talking about Emily Wilding Davison, about how... you know, I think it's when they were making a TV program, but it can't have been the one you're talking about, where they hold her brown leather purse that she took to that day at the races, and how moving that is. And that's kind of, I think what is interesting about, not that a lot of clothes exist anymore that suffragettes wore, but the banners and the things that were in the Museum of London and the embroidered handkerchiefs, it's this thing of that direct connection you can get to people of that time by seeing something material.
Yeah.
Which is quite moving, and they have one of Emmeline Pankhurst's shoes in the Museum of London, which is kind of quite like, once you know quite a bit about them, it's quite exciting.
Was it? So when we met Diane Atkinson, wasn't she saying that in the 30s, they, like the Suffragette Fellowship, set out to kind of collect as much as they could of the memorabilia so that they could keep it safe and that we would have it today. Mm. So thank God they did.
Yeah.
So there's also, there was a suffragette uniform, I don't know how many people wore this, there's definitely that picture that you've put up of Rose Lamartine.
Yes.
I can't remember her whole name, Yates. And there's also Daisy Dugdale, there's a picture of her, I think she was Una Dugdale's sister, wearing this uniform, which they kind of encouraged people to wear when prisoners were freed from Holloway Jail, so they had these kind of receptions for it. So what it says is that we heartily urge all those who can do so to make a special effort to wear the uniform. It will consist of a short skirt of purple or green, a white golf jersey and a simple hat of purple or green. The regalia sash will be worn over the right shoulder and be fastened under the arm. But no one really knows who designed it or who manufactured it. Mm. And it was likely the idea was suggested by the staff and volunteers of Clements Inn. But I don't know how many people really wore that. I kind of feel like there's not a lot of images of it.
Yeah, I haven't seen much. But then I guess if they're just wearing it like every day, why would you take a photo of it?
I
didn't take a picture of myself in my...
I know, but I just think like there's not many... I don't know.
You wear tracksuit.
yeah, you do.
I actually don't. I wear pyjamas, like, time.
So I'm just going to try and speed up a bit, but you, Amy, touched on Christina Broome's photos, which are also in the Museum of London, and there's a beautiful book of them. And she wasn't a suffragette, but she was, again, someone that recognised the potential of it to sell postcards of images of suffragettes. And there's some beautiful images of women at the WSPU members at their big fundraiser they had, which was a women's exhibition in May 1909, and it was in something like the Prince's Skating Ring, I think, which no longer exists.
Was it in Kensington?
Yeah. And so there's one person that I'm really interested in, but it's really hard to find any information about, who's Amy Cotts, who had a stall, she donated dresses for a stall at this women's exhibition. And I've spoken to Elizabeth, who Amy mentioned before, is our museum curator here. And I've emailed all these people about her because her work was really beautiful. And she's supposed to have worked at Liberty's doing embroidery on trains of dresses and then set up her own dressmakers. And she advertised in Votes for Women. And she kind of pops up in numerous articles about suffrage fashion, but there's no existing garments left of hers. And nobody seems to know a huge amount. So I've kind of tried everybody.
However, Elizabeth did manage to... We've got a photo of her dresses here, and Elizabeth did manage to find a sort of smock dress.
Yeah,
very similar. So we'll put it on a mannequin.
Oh,
and get
yeah, I haven't actually
it.
Seen it yet.
It's like behind you. It's gorgeous.
So I would say definitely some of the clothes in this picture, they do have this look of aesthetic and reform dress, which is the example we have at work, and they do have this beautiful embroidery on that is sort of grapes and vine leaves, and
it's gorgeous.
It's just really lovely, and I think again, it's really, and we think she might be the woman sitting in the front sewing. And I just like her hair and everything, which is kind of what my hair looks like a lot of the time.
You have great Edwardian hair.
Yeah. So I have a bit of an affinity with that. But I just find it really interesting because, again, she's not some big fancy, you know, couturier, but she is somebody who had a business and then, you know, sold her work. Apparently Emmeline Pankhurst bought one of her dresses. But it would just be great to know more about her.
Yeah.
But... to say, like, thanks to everybody who I've emailed about this, because they've been so helpful and interested, which is very kind. And there's a place in near Exeter, a house, a National Trust place called Killerton, and they have an exhibition on at the moment, which is about women and it's women's suffrage fashion. And it's called Branded Fashion, Femininity and the Right to Vote. And Shelley Tombe there was really helpful. But they have a dress on display that is a bit similar to an Amy Cotts dress, but I thought it was one and unfortunately it isn't. But if you're in that area, I would go to that exhibition because it should be really interesting. So I'm just going to skip through because we're running out of time.
We should start a blog.
Yeah.
We should, like, put all of this on...
Oh God, like I haven't enough time. Well. We're gonna.
Well, you are doing another episode on sort of.
This kind of won't maybe thin, but it's just we're at work, so we're gonna get kicked out of work or get in a load of trouble.
After work, for anyone who's listening who's from work.
Yeah. We'll keep going until we're kicked out.
I wanted to talk a bit about the suffragists, just particularly because when you talked about the mud march in your marches episode, you sort of mentioned about them getting caked in mud. And because it'd been raining so much. So when they did their pilgrimage, they were specifically said, like, your skirt should be 4 inches off the ground, so to kind of avoid that. And then they made this big thing about how they wanted women to be wearing black, white, grey or navy. They wanted them to look really smart and they didn't want them to wear tweed. And obviously not to wear any of the colours of a WSPU, because the whole point of this march is to kind of show that women could be peaceful and get the vote through what they deemed as legitimate means. But, you know, Hannah did touch a bit on that, so I'm going to not necessarily go over it a lot. But there were people that really, they did want to wear tweed because they were just like, wearing grey and navy and black, like marching. Yeah, they got really dusty and dirty and... that but again, it was this idea of wearing tweed, it's like we don't want them to look matronly, masculine
or mannish. Yeah,
yeah, but they kind of relented and let people wear what they want. There was one really sweet woman, Gladys Duffield, who joined the march along the way, that was just inspired by going to her I think it was in Cockermouth, it was around the Lake District, I think, and she just kind of went and decided, like, yes, I'm going to join this pilgrimage, which is really cool. And her mother-in-law is actually secretly a suffragist, and she looked after her daughter and her husband was in India, so she wrote him a letter, like, knowing he wouldn't get it in time, like, to be like, no, can't do that.
That's hilarious.
She, like, pulled out this ancient purple outfit, and then they were like, oh, that's the wrong colours, obviously. So she was completely mortified and then switched it. But there's lots of nice stuff about her, and she just seemed like a really, like, just one of those people that you'd like to be around. There was also a really funny thing about an American suffragist who, when she was visiting on a march, she was called Alice Paul. She wrapped herself with black wool and, like, put a coat on over top as kind of padding, because they also, actually, I'll mention that afterwards. So, but it kind of was too padded, and the buttons burst at some point, and all the, like, rolls, like, fell out. Like,
why did she wrap herself in?
I don't really get this. I'm like, do they mean, well, they didn't say.
Do you think it was, like,
black cotton wool? Yeah.
Well, you did say because of the.
Yeah, just to kind, like, of, so they suggested using cardboard, and they, there's also a point where they say, lie in the bath with the cardboard to shape around your body. It's like,
what? Well, to explain, like, using cardboard is like, protection against any sort of,
it's like as armory,
as,
yeah,
like armor, not like, like a stab vest, but obviously not against knives, it's against, like, people punch
you very much.
It's just like a layer.
Yeah, I mean, that's what
for
would,
people when the police got a bit rough.
The interesting is having more examples of like practical dress, maybe for marching and stuff like that, but there's not, but maybe they just didn't, so like that doesn't exist. So just to kind of bring up a current example, and we were thinking about all these T-shirts that people have done in the last few years. That so there's the We Should All Be Feminists, which is from that small book by the novelist, which I'm also not going to say right, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, I think. But then there was also This Pussy Grabs Back, which I can't see at the moment who was... Who did that one? But that's obviously become, like, in the last few years, it's an identification with feminist ideals.
Yeah.
Which has become quite important. And there's also, there was, This Is What a Feminist Looks Like.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't there.
Yeah.
So there's been, but there's some issues, and I was looking at an article from The Guardian, and they were sort of saying, oh, well, it's not so important where these T-shirts are produced. And it's like, well, actually it is. That's completely outrageous to say that's not important, because to me it's like, you can't call yourself a feminist and then be prepared to wear clothing that has been produced by other women.
Yes.
What was that woman called? Nazar Akhtar, that we were listening to at the March for Women.
Yes.
And she started working in sweatshops in Bangladesh from the age of 14?
I think was it 11. It was 11. Yeah, it was 11.
And she just said, basically, if you buy cheap clothes, you don't respect women. Because,
yeah.
And it was quite awkward to listen to, because we knew the whole audience was guilty.
I was wearing Topshop clothes
at some point.
And I was like, oh God, like, well, I am the problem.
There was somebody that said, I think on the anniversary of the Representation of the People Act, and she said that it's all very well to say all these things, but I didn't have a nanny because I don't have any children, but I doubt I'll ever have one anyway. But she was saying, if you had a nanny or you have a cleaner, think about how you treat those women.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's like, it's fine to kind of put up hashtag Me Too and things, but if you don't, if you just want stuff cheap,
don't practice what you preach.
Yeah. Then that's just hypocritical.
We were talking to our friend Ellie, who has a really amazing blog on sustainable fashion called Take It Up, Wear It Out. She also is on Instagram under that name, and it's really good. You should definitely check it out. But she was saying, we're talking about what you wear as a form of activism. You know, like, her whole thing is about sustainable fashion, and she... to practice what you preach, you know, she, you know, mends stuff when it's teared, she doesn't just chuck stuff away, and like all this sort of stuff. It is a form of activism for people who don't necessarily want to be the sort of aggressive, that sort of, doing that sort of activism, and she's right. And I'm sure for the suffragettes, like, wearing a badge, it might not, you know, that in itself was a form of activism, especially at the time, because being a suffragette was, you know, quite a controversial thing.
And interestingly, we were talking to her the other day, and Ellie was saying that since she started this blog, she's made a really conscious effort to try and look as glamorous as she possibly can.
Yes.
Because she doesn't want to kind of get the label that she's, you know, like a hippie wearing hemp. Yeah. And scratchy clothes. Like, she always looks incredible. She's one of the most glamorous people I've ever known.
Yeah.
But she does it in a way that is so sustainable and so ethical that she's such an inspiration.
It is really hard to do. But, yeah, I mean, it is really admirable to the extent that she is, you know, really living by her
She does
morals,
things like...
Really.
She had a hole in something and she... It kind of covered it up. She embroidered like a little bug or something.
Yeah,
over
it was awesome.
I was like, that's so cool.
Such a good idea. And then her blog is full of that stuff.
Yeah, so we're going to get chucked out and get in lots of trouble.
Yeah, George is eyeballing us through the window.
There was some other stuff I wanted to mention, but I'm not going to mention it. So, what a shame. You'll be disappointed.
But stay tuned for the merchandise episode.
For fashion part two, merchandising that Amy's going to do in a few weeks.
So just quickly before we go, if there's anything that you want us to particularly talk about, or if you've got any feedback for us about our podcast, you can contact us on thesuffragettecity@gmail.com. And we also sell charity t-shirts, like we've been talking about,
which are made ethically.
They are by a company called Rapa Nui. And you can buy them on Tmall, and they are made from organic cotton and made sustainably in wind powered factories, so you don't have to feel guilty. They're still cheap, but they're done in a very ethical way. And you can buy those at suffragettecity.tmall.co.uk. And you can also follow us on Instagram at the.suffragette.city, where, like we said, we'll be posting lots of pictures of all the things that we've been talking about.
So thanks for that episode, Amy. That was really interesting and awesome. And I can't wait for your next one.
Part two.
Cool.
All right. Okay.
Thanks for listening, guys. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Hi, this is Amy Toll here again. Because we were kind of rushing the podcast a bit because we were going to be kicked out of the building, I missed off just saying thanks to a few people. So firstly, when I mentioned Amy Cotts, there were a couple of people I emailed who were really helpful. So one of them was Callie Blackman, who I also took quite a few quotes from some articles she wrote. And also Anna and Eleanor at the Liberty Archive, who were very, very helpful. And some of the books that I also used were two by Diane Atkinson, one called Purple, White and Green, and the other is The Suffragettes in Pictures, and they're both really good books. So if you're interested in a bit more about fashion and merchandising with suffragettes, definitely worth getting. Okay, thanks very much.